For Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Between April 19th and April 23rd, Carthage College is going to be welcoming to its campus a visiting writer by the name of Sadiq Fofana. And this is an event which is primarily designed with the Carthage community in mind in terms of opportunities for him to work with Carthage students. But there are also going to be a couple of different opportunities for the community to engage with Sadiq Fofana. And we're going to be talking about that a little bit later in the hour. But first, we're going to be meeting this gifted writer who is heralded for a book that I believe is still to be fully published and released to the public, but a book called Stories from the Tenants Downstairs, which is set in a Harlem high-rise, low-income high-rise, and features interconnecting stories. And this book has already garnered tremendous anticipation and praise, and I am eager to read it when it becomes available. But I'm very happy today to be able to talk to its author and find out a little bit about his life, which includes not only writing, but also teaching. He is a teacher in a public school in Brooklyn, a proud graduate of NYU, and again, Sadiq Fofana, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks, Greg. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm very honored. And thanks for the opportunity to get to talk to you.
I think it's really important for our listeners and for me to know a bit about you, about where you come from originally, and as you were growing up, wherever that was, at what point in time writing became something really important to you.
Well, by ethnicity, I am West African. My parents are born in Sierra Leone. I was born in Houston, Texas, but I only lived there for 12 months, and I grew up in Boston. So for all of high school, I grew up in Boston, and I left Boston at 18 to go to school in New York City. And as far as writing, I've always been creative or tried to be creative. First it was poetry. And then when I was around 7 or 8, it was hip hop. So my literary genre of choice is the hip hop verse. And so I wrote a lot of like verses and songs. And then right around the end of college, kind of had a moment, an awakening moment, where I asked myself, you know, I love music so much, but if there were no music, what would I do creatively? And the answer was to just write, it would be to write stories. And so the tail end of undergrad, very beginning of my time as a recent grad, right after I graduated college, started writing stories, and it was just an apprenticeship that kind of turned into something a bit more serious, where I sought out MFA programs. I was lucky enough to get into NYU's program, and I kind of took it from there and just kept revising and rewriting stories. But, you know, I'm a Bostonian by heart, West African by heart, and also now a New Yorker. I've lived in New York longer than I lived in Boston. And, you know, reading, writing, and creating have been with me since a young age. Hmm.
Can you tell us anything about what prompted your parents to leave Sierra Leone for the United States? Did anything in particular draw them here?
Yeah, school did. They wanted to attend the college. So my parents came here in 1976. My mother was 21 and my dad was mid-20s. And for my dad, it was to go to school for like business administration. My mother was attending a four-year college, but then she transferred to a community college. And the plan was that they would do the, they would go to school in the United States and they would come right back to Sierra Leone. That was the plan. And they had an, you know, my mother came from like a kind of middle class upbringing. And so my grandmother gave them the option, like, where in the world would you want to continue education? And they said the United States. And my grandmother asked, where in the United States? And they said Boston. And so the plan was for them to go to school and then to come back. And at the time, Sierra Leone was a very developed country. And my parents like to brag that the currency in Sierra Leone was actually worth more than the dollar in the mid 70s. But between them leaving and you know, the few or so years that they took to go to school, the country went through some turmoil. There's more poverty. There's a little bit more government corruption. And so coming back was not an option. And so they stayed in the United States. And that was 1976, and 7 years later, I was born, 1983.
So tell us about your experience of growing up. And I ask that because this highly anticipated book you've written called Stories from the Tenants Downstairs is set in a Harlem low-income high-rise. Mm-hmm. Is that any reflection whatsoever of any of your childhood or the setting in which you grew up, or was your childhood, your upbringing in a very different setting and situation?
It was, I would say yes and no. Like, I grew up, I did not grow up rich. I would classify my upbringing as lower middle class. So, you know, if the building Stories from Our Tenants Downstairs or Stories from the Tenants Downstairs was in Boston, it would be in the neighborhood that I grew up. But I grew up in a three-family house. So my neighborhood in 1983 in the mid-80s was a very abandoned neighborhood. It was mostly people of color, mostly Black people. It's one of the poorest at the time neighborhoods in Boston. Lots of abandoned houses. Years before, it was middle class. But then right after the late 60s, the assassination of Martin Luther King, it started to go downhill. So by the time I moved there, it was, you know, a very neglected neighborhood. And my house that I grew up in was actually an abandoned house. And so my parents kind of put a little bit of money down. I want to say the deposit was $500. There was a program that the city had at the time where if you put down a little bit of money, then you could petition the city to pay to renovate the house. in this neighborhood that really nobody really wanted to live in. And so my parents put down their $500 deposit and they bought a three-family house. And so growing up, I lived on the first floor, and then there were tenants on the second and the third floor. And we were stone's throw away from public housing. We all kind of just intermixed, played around. We're all kids growing up in the neighborhood. But to think of it in terms of like, did I grow up poor? It's very hard to think about that, because poverty is a relative thing. You don't know you're poor until you see someone who has more than you. Mm. And so growing up, we all pretty much had the same thing. So we didn't think of ourselves as rich or poor. We thought ourselves as we had everything that we needed. And I never, growing up, had that thought of like, oh my God, it's so harsh. It's so harsh living in Roxbury. This is, even though maybe scholars might write about it that way, as kids viscerally living in Roxbury, I don't think we ever were like, oh, this is just unbearable. This is unbearable. And so I didn't get the concept of maybe I didn't have as much as others until I went to private school. I went to public school from kindergarten to sixth grade. Yeah, I guess I grew up poor, but I didn't really know it until I saw people have more than me.
Hmm. It sounds like you also grew up in a neighborhood in which, as you've already said, people's lives were very much interconnected. And so you were, in a sense, a part of each other's lives, not really insulated from each other's stories. And I suspect that might be at least part of where some of your inspiration comes for stories from the tenants downstairs. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, definitely. And I think I always like to think of the building and stories from the tenants downstairs as a metaphor for a community of people in a big city. And in Boston, that's what we were. And a lot of these characters in the book are amalgamations of people that I knew from Boston and from New York. And sometimes I can't even tell the difference, because I think in a lot of urban communities, there's a certain, there's a community aspect, and there are certain roles that people fill with pride, and there's certain roles that people fill out of necessity. And so, yes, a lot of these characters are inspired by people I grew up with in Boston, because that sense of community is there when you live in the inner city and you live in close quarters, whether it be in the building, three-family house, or whether it's someone's down the street from you, but you all gather for the neighborhood barbecue or cookout.
We're speaking with Sadiq Fofana, and he is coming to Carthage College a little bit later in the month of April as a visiting writer. And there are a couple of different public events that we will be talking about in just a few minutes with our other guest, Cameron Swallow. Sadiq Fofana, I want to know more about what it was like to be growing up in that kind of neighborhood, interested in the things in which you were interested. As a young man who was interested in writing and poetry and being creative and so on, I'm curious, among other things, how that was viewed by your peers, who perhaps wondered why you weren't more interested in playing basketball or whatever, and also what it was like to, in a sense, live a creative life in that kind of setting. And in a sense, what did creativity mean for you? What did it represent for you in your life?
Yeah, I mean, I think growing up, I was into the stuff that other kids was into. They, you know, I was basketball player. Like, I love basketball. And I met a lot of my friends in the neighborhood playing basketball. I played varsity from 10th to 12th. So that was part of my experience. And again, hip hop was a part of my experience too. So it was like most of the people in my neighborhood, we bonded through music, through playing sports, just being people of color in a city. I mean, I felt a little bit of alienation in that, like, I, from 7th through 12th, I didn't go to public school. And so my day in my neighborhood would be like waking up really early in the morning and taking the train almost outside of the city to go to private school that was a predominantly white institution. But during the summer times and sometimes in the evening, in the spring, I was just another neighborhood kid. I like to think of that. I like to think of hip hop as a, you know, I get so intimidated by these writers who are like, I read every day as a child, you know, the age of 8. Like, I'm like, if I'm ever interviewed, I can't say that. I cannot say that I was like a voracious reader. I liked books. I had binges. I had a Roald Dahl binge. I remember reading Animal Farm very, very early. And in high school, whatever they gave me to read for homework, I read. But I didn't read like on my own voraciously. And, you know, I think when people ask the question about like creativity and reading, I think a embedded question is like, what was the apprenticeship? Like, how did you learn how to write? And I asked myself that question. And the only answer I can come up with is like, again, hip hop. I'm like, if I'm reading, like, if a hip hop artist is a poet with music, and what you're listening to is poetry over musical accompaniment, and every day on the train, you have the equivalent to the New Yorker poetry podcast with music in your ears every day, that has to account for some kind of literary training. And I think that I would point to that. Just like people who are a few years older than me point to like comic books as like an early like literary endeavor. I really do point to like listening to hip hop verses and that kind of like the organic intellectualism that comes from that. Even to this day when I'm writing stories, my main reference point, and I'm thinking of like a narrative issue, is I'll go to like stories that Biggie wrote and told via hip hop verse, and Nas via hip hop verse. So, yeah, I mean, a short answer to that was like being creative and liking books and stories never really alienated me from my peers because we just bonded through basketball and hip hop, which I felt like in itself was another like intellectual conversation discussion that was going on.
Excellent. I'm curious, when you went off to college and and I think that was to NYU to study creative writing. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah. I went, my undergrad was Columbia and then I went to NYU for writing.
Great. Now, what I'm wondering is, what did your professors make of this background that you brought? I mean, that, for instance, for you, so much of the inspiration, the lifeblood of at least much of your writing came from this phenomenon of hip hop. Was that something that they had encountered before? Or, I mean, was that something that they could sort of fold into the curriculum or into a framework in which they were going to teach you to be a better writer? Or was this, in a sense, brand new ground for all of you?
Well, I feel like in my neighborhood, people knew I played basketball and people knew I rapped, but they didn't know that I was at Roxbury Latin reading Henry David Thoreau and translating Greek Greek poetry. At Columbia, professors knew I was a student that got. It was more a thing that other students knew, and I think that question is a viable one because most of the students, again, it's another predominantly white institution, but at the same time, more diverse than most, where we had students from all over the country, all over the world. And a lot of them were hip hop fans. And I think they were like conventional fans who, you know, experienced a lot of their hip hop on wax, on CD. But then to have like occasionally a few of us on campus, I wasn't the only one, to see that live hip hop performance and coming from one of their peers. I think that was just part of the experiment of college. You know, it's like, ideally you want to be on a campus where you have students who represent a vast array of experiences. And I like to think that maybe, you know, that I brought the inner city experience and the someone who's a poet, but a poet through instrumentals and through boom bap beats. I like to think that maybe I was that person who provided that experience, but my professors had no idea. I did do poetry books, and I gave a shout out to one of my professors, Robin D.G. Kelly, in it. And I used to sell these books for like $4 or $5, and he bought one, so he knew I wrote poetry. Very few of my professors knew I rapped. I was mostly like strictly academic in their presence.
Hmm. What would you say was the most significant development in your writing, in terms of becoming a better writer? Mm. What would be sort of the arc of improvement? What about your writing has improved through the course of your studies, for instance, and just then your experience of doing more and more? Maybe another way to ask the question is, if we looked at, for instance, this new book, Stories from the Tenants Downstairs, mm-hmm. how would it compare to maybe comparable efforts from some years ago?
Mm. I think the key thing is revising and sitting with it. I wrote my first story at the age of 23, and I want to say after the first or second draft. And by second draft, proof, like minor proof, copy edits, I was ready to send it out. But I think going into my late 20s, I started to look back on some of those and then cringe a little bit, and not necessarily find the solace in the publication, but to begin thinking about, well, was this a best representation of my ability? And was this piece put out in front of the world in its most realized form? Hmm. And so I think late 20s, early 30s, it started to become like, I'm going to draft and redraft and make sure that things are in their most realized form. Something that I read that another writer wrote.
So you've evolved to the place where you understand that just because something ushers from your pen doesn't necessarily mean it is the best that it can be. As someone who is a music prophet, Carthage, and occasionally works with young people who are aspiring composers, that's sometimes a really hard lesson for them to learn, is just because they've noodled around on the piano and come up with something, that doesn't mean it's something particularly original or compelling or what they really want to say. And finding the wastebasket has a function for any young composer or writer is sometimes a difficult lesson for people to learn. It sounds like at some point you learned that lesson, and now it has certainly paid off handsomely.
You learn later to step outside yourself, and then look at your work, how someone else would look at it. And that's a scary, that's scary, but it's all, it ultimately leads to growth. Hmm.
So you are living a life that includes writing, but also teaching. Mm-hmm. You are teaching someplace in Brooklyn. Tell us about the school in which you're teaching and what you are teaching there.
Oh yeah. I teach in Bushwick at a school called the Brooklyn School for Math and Research. And it's on the Bushwick campus. So many years ago, the school was simply called Bushwick High School. And it was a big school with thousands of students. But in the recent years, I think it was a Bloomberg initiative, a lot of the big New York City schools were divided into smaller schools. So my school is on the Bushwick campus, and the Bushwick campus houses four schools, of which mine is one. So my school is on the second and third floor. It's called the Brooklyn School for Math and Research. I teach English language arts there. You know, there's a focus on math, but we still have a strong English department. And I think teaching informs my writing. It gives me challenges. It allows me to people watch, see how students, how people face obstacles. I see organic genius regularly. So,
very good. Are you excited about coming to Carthage College? And what are your hopes and expectations about what you're going to get to do here?
Oh yeah, I'm very excited to come to Carthage College. And it's my very first time doing a visiting writers, being part of the visiting writers series for any campus. And so I'm super enthusiastic about that. Now, from what I've, you know, read and what I've understood about visiting writers, like the, you know, that time, most of the time it's you come to a campus, you do a reading, you interact with some students, and then you call it a day. But what makes this particular week where I'm so amped up is that there are community events tied into it. And I love the idea of being on campus, interacting with prospective teachers, which is on the agenda, and then doing the reading, and excited about being on campus. But I'm also excited with about meeting with the Barbershop Collective and being part of the other community events, being able to visit a school and do some creative writing with some teenagers, some kids. And I think that's what a visiting writers week should be. It should be like, get to come to a glorious campus and do a reading, but then there should always be some kind of community aspect. And I feel like one of the things I appreciate about Carthage is that I was asked, like, what would you want to have, to experience during that week? And I had no idea, and there were some suggestions made. But now that I know that this is within the realm of possibilities, if any other campus asked me that again, I would definitely say, let's reach out to a community organization and do an event. So super excited.
Terrific, with good reason. Sadiq Fofana, who is coming to the campus of Carthage College and to the community of Kenosha April 19th through the 23rd. I'm really happy that also in this Zoom call is Cameron Swallow, who has been on the morning show before. And Cameron Swallow has been a key component in the planning of this event, and in particular, some of the community involvement that is going to be part of Sadiq Fofana's visit. Cameron Swallow, we welcome you to the program and glad that you can join us.
Thank you, Greg, for the welcome. And I'm so excited to see you, or not see you, but hear you here, Sadiq, and really looking forward to welcoming you to our Wisconsin community as we welcomed you to our Tennessee community all those years ago.
Yes.
So, Cameron, tell us about that. Tell us what this previous encounter was between you and Sadiq Fofana.
Well, the Sewanee Review is a literary journal that is published at our former institution, our alma mater, the University of the South in Sewanee, Tennessee. And the new editor of the Sewanee Review at that time, Adam Ross, he is still the editor, but he had just become the editor when he published Sadiq's story, The Okie Doke, and invited Sadiq to campus to do a reading. And it was like nothing we had ever experienced in Sewanee. Speaking for myself entirely, but it was so exciting to be part of the new chapter of this old literary journal, and to be part of welcoming Sadiq to Sewanee, and to be part of sort of the launch of a new and important distinctive literary voice. We were just excited to feel like we were in on the ground floor of something new and exciting. And now to be able to invite him to Kenosha, Wisconsin, in sort of a second chapter, second level of his emergence in the literary scene, feels like an excellent follow-up.
Very good. So explain what is planned for Sadiq Fofana's visit to southeastern Wisconsin coming up a little bit later this April.
Well, I'd be sure to leave off something if I really tried to summarize the itinerary, because I think that Dean Ness has it very tightly packed and organized. I do know that he will be speaking at a couple of high schools where prospective students are considering Carthage, and that would so it's like publicity for Carthage at some of the places that we are recruiting students. And I know that he's going to be speaking to actual current Carthage students by visiting some classes and giving a reading on Wednesday night. And then the event that I'm the most specifically involved with is the community meeting at the Regimen Barber Collective on 52nd Street in downtown Kenosha. Alvin Owens has a real community center going on there at the collective, and we are using it to the fullest. We have passed out copies of the Okie Doke short story to clients of Alvin's barbershop, and to a group called the African American Youth Initiative that is through the Kenosha Unified School District. It is officially the spring break of Kenosha Unified, so the students aren't being assigned this through school, which if you've read the first page of it, you would know they couldn't be assigned this story through school. So they're going to feel very excited about getting to be asked to read this story, because it has some language in it that would not fly in any kind of official school function. But those students are going to be invited for that Friday of their spring break to come and participate in a discussion of the story and a presentation by Sadiq, which may include reading some portion of that story in his voice.
Marvelous. That is something to look forward to. So circling back to your first encounter with Sadiq Fofana down in Sewanee, where you and your husband were before you came to Carthage, what made it so extraordinary and in contrast to similar sorts of events that had come before it? I mean, what do you feel like was the unique, compelling factor in that event with Sadiq Fofana?
Well, I was an undergraduate at Sewanee, and I was for 6 years there as the wife of an administrator, and I had never heard anyone speak in the accent, the cadence, and the language used throughout the okey-doke, the authentic language of the inner city world that he describes in such detail and such pathos. It's beautiful, and it rings true from the very beginning, and it was an exposure that Sewanee is not accustomed to getting. And I'm sure I would make a mistake if I said that it had never intersected Sewanee's life at all. But in my experience, it was a first, and it was exciting and refreshing to come into contact with another culture like that.
Sadiq Fofana, a last question about this major book that is soon to be released to the public, Stories from the Tenants Downstairs, in which you have 8 interconnected stories all set in this Banneker Homes low-income high-rise. It sounds like you have a various stories that, among other things, include all kinds of very, very serious, sometimes even ferocious challenges and difficulties for the characters in question. Challenges which sometimes they meet almost heroically, and probably other challenges in which some of them maybe succumb to temptation or whatever. How much do you think about, as you craft a book like this, and in particular stories like this, about the balance between being realistic versus being inspirational, versus conveying reality about what it's like to live in a place like this, versus avoiding the common stereotypes? I mean, it seems like there are a lot of things to think about in order to mm-hmm. tell these stories as compellingly as possible. What did you think about and ponder as you constructed this?
I thought about all of that, and I thought about it from a very, very scared, very scary place, because there's a lot of tightrope walking that's involved when you take on an endeavor like this. And Cameron, I appreciate your kind words and remembering me throughout that, all that time. That really means a lot. And so, yeah, I thought of, I think everything that I wrote about, every story that I've written about, I've definitely either witnessed or know of multiple people who have been in that situation. And so that one, I think it's coming to be known as the Margaret Atwood rule from Handmaid's Tale. She said, I didn't make any of this up. Like, anything that happened in a Handmaid's Tale has happened in life. It has happened in the world. It's happened in society. And, I think a similar thing is that, and it's a scary notion for us as Americans to reckon with that, and as I'm writing, I'm like, oh my God, am I writing a cliche? Am I writing a stereotype? Am I portraying people of color in a not so good light? And the question I would always ask myself as I'm writing and as I'm thinking through these challenges, is there a person that exists that I know that has gone through something similar? And, you know, for these stories at least, yes, people like this, they exist. And my follow-up question is, do they deserve their stories to be told? And the answer is undoubtedly yes. The last thing I'll say is, it was a scary experience the whole time, because you're like, I want to write about certain people, but I know people will say, like, this is a cliche, or there's always a little person in my heart. My artist self, my greater artist self is wants praise, wants approval. But then there's a tiny person in my heart that's rebellious and ready to do something edgy. And hopefully those two kind of reconcile. But yes, I did think about that a lot. And I appreciate that question.
So what is next for you in terms of your writing career? Are you hard at work on a new work?
I am. I'm working on shorter fiction. So my stories are like 15 to 40 pages now. And now I'm working on stories that are like 3 to 10 pages. And part of it is because I'm a teacher, and those stories that I can teach in a class period or even in a week, a couple of class periods that are like anywhere from 3 to 5 pages at the most 10. And I see how that works well in the classroom. So that's kind of been the model that I've like been ingrained in me. And it's kind of how I've chosen text to teach. It's also my way of, not saying I'm not going to write a novel, because there's a lot of pressure. So I'm going to, as long as I'm being asked that question, I will be writing my short fiction. And that kind of like alleviates some pressure and also helps me work on something that I could feasibly finish in a reasonable time.
Well, Sadiq Fofana, it has been marvelous to get to know you. And I, along with many other people, are very, very excited about your upcoming visit to the campus of Carthage College and to the greater Kenosha community as well. And I appreciate you making time in your busy schedule for this conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. And I look forward to my Wisconsin visit.
Very good. And Cameron Swallow, thank you for your hard work to help make Sadiq Fofana's visit to Carthage and to Kenosha even more exciting and meaningful. And thank you for being part of the morning show as well.
Thanks for the invitation, Greg.
You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For part two of today's program, we're dipping into the morning show archives. This interview was recorded back in 2020. And I am so grateful to be able to have a few minutes to speak with Sonia Manzano, who is beloved to many for her part of Sesame Street for many years, with the beloved character Maria, but also the author of a number of wonderful books, including a memoir, Becoming Maria, Love and Chaos in the South Bronx. Her most recent book, her first book for National Geographic, is called A World Together. And this is a book that the world really needs. And it is a beautiful exploration of just what makes our world so beautiful and rich, and how in our diversity we find layers of beauty that we would otherwise never be able to see. And we have a couple of minutes to speak with Sonia Manzano about what inspired her to write this book, A World Together. Sonia Manzano, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you so much. My pleasure to talk about the book. I jumped at the chance when National Geographic asked me to write a book about diversity, seeing as the state we find the world in today, and especially our country. I'm especially chagrined of the state of affairs, since I thought that Sesame Street had sort of solved all those problems in 1969 and the result of the civil rights movement and the idealism of President Johnson when he wanted to create the Great Society way back in the 70s. So if there's one thing I've learned, it's that just because you address a problem in one generation doesn't mean it's going to spill over into the coming generation. Mm. So it was time for a good book about sharing all the ways that we are the same, in that we feel sad and we feel happy and we all want shelter and we all feel hungry and we all are satisfied when we eat something good, are all the ways that we're the same part of the human condition. The only ways we're different is culturally, and those are the cultural things we should celebrate.
Mm. So explain to our listeners what they find in the pages of this book, both in
your words, your lovingly crafted words, but also in the splendid visuals that are also part of this book.
Yes, Lori Epstein, the photo editor at National Geographic, did a smashing, wonderful job of showing all kinds of kids in all kinds of situations. I wanted some urban images, and she complied by having that wonderful image of the kids playing by a fire hydrant, because that was kind of my experience as a kid growing up in the Bronx. And I was also interested in not shying away from showing a sad image, and we have a picture of a looks like a soldier kissing his child goodbye, and the words that go with it say, "And when people feel scared, they sometimes forget that deep down we're all the same." Mm-hmm. And I suppose I'm reacting to the fact that I see so much anger out there, more than I thought people felt, but clearly they do. And that must come out of fear, and we forget that we're the same. And that picture, coupled with those words, might inspire conversations in that direction or not. Or someone will just say, well, that's like just a sad picture and leave it at that. So I hope it is a book that starts when you close the last page.
What do you think it is that keeps some people from embracing and celebrating this notion of our diversity? What is it that makes that to some people an idea that they just don't warm up to and maybe even feel even kind of repelled by or afraid of? What are people afraid of when it comes to diversity?
I don't know why people are afraid. I honestly don't, and I was struck by a quote. I want to say it was Carrie Mae Weems, but I don't know if she said that, an African-American artist. If it wasn't her, I apologize, but who said, "I look and I look and I look in the mirror, but I don't see what is so frightening." And those words stay with me. And, you know, I do a voice on an animated show for Nickelodeon where I play a Mexican grandmother. Now, it's very funny. I enjoy myself because they keep correcting my Puerto Rican Spanish. It's a little different. It's a little different. And the food, you know, I'll have to pronounce foods that begin with the letter X. And I don't know how to pronounce them. So they'll help me with the pronunciation. But that doesn't frighten me that they're different. I enjoy it. It doesn't frighten me when I read Sherman Alexie books and I learn about Native American experience. It's curious. It's different from mine. It's when I read about a poor child on a reservation. I was a poor child in the Bronx, but they're very different experiences. And it just, I'm curious about it, not frightened. I don't know why some people find any change in anyone's lifestyle or behavior so frightening. I'm at a loss.
In the last 20 seconds, what did you learn from all of your work on Sesame Street that helped you understand and appreciate diversity?
Humor. Humor will go very, very far. People will laugh at the same things. And I think that's why Sesame Street is such a success worldwide, because people will have a sense of humor and usually find the same things universally humorous.
Funny how laughter opens up the heart. And I love your book, A World Together, published by National Geographic. Sonia Manzano, thank you for giving it to the world.
Thank you so much. Stay well.
tomorrow on the morning show, it is the monthly visit of Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College. And with him will be the executive director of a nonprofit organization called Building Our Future. On Thursday, it's Nan Calvert paying her monthly visit to the program. And her guest, Kathleen Thompson, will be talking with us about the beauty and wonder